thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 104, recorded March 21st, 2014. Social Science History, Electric Boogaloo.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Digital Campus. This is episode 104, and we're recording March 21st, 2014, on a day when rumors of spring seem like a little bit less than a cruel joke than they usually have. We've had a very hard winter. We've got Stephen Robertson here, the director of the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Amanda.
We have Professor Mills Kelly here. Hello, Mills.
Hello, Amanda.
I am Amanda French. I am Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media VATCamp coordinator for another 10 days, I think. We also have a guest host, Joan Troiano, who works on Press Forward here at the center. Hello, Joan.
Hello, glad to be here.
We're also joined by two of our digital history fellows. We often are joined by the digital history fellows, but I wanted to make sure I introduced them this time. We have Spencer Roberts. Hello, Spencer.
Hi, how are you?
And Anne McDivitt.
Hello.
Hi. And we have a few stories to talk about. It seems like it's been a fairly slow tech news week. I'm sorry we won't get a chance to hear from Mills, who is an Eastern European scholar, about the Crimea. But nevertheless, we're going to focus on technology and the academy, as we usually do. And we thought we would start with a story that we're all quite interested in about a new $1.6 million Mellon grant to the American Historical Association to revamp doctoral programs to allow for more diverse career options for history PhDs. Mills, you blogged about this story. Would you like to tell us what you said in your blog post?
Sure. Well, just to, without rehashing the blog post itself, what I would say is, you know, so this is really a great thing in my view, because for far too long, the best of the history PhD programs in the United States have been focused almost entirely, not all of them, but most of them have been focused almost entirely on preparing their doctoral students for tenure track jobs at institutions like themselves, research institutions, where those people will then go on to teach more graduate students. And the fact is, I think it's an unfortunate fact, but it's a fact nonetheless, the market for those positions is getting smaller all the time. And so this grant is really targeted at that, in many ways, at that market reality, which is that the number of sort of research faculty history positions is going to get smaller. And so we need to really think carefully about what kinds of career options we're preparing our students for. It's something that we do a lot of here at George Mason, but that's sort of an artifact of the, you know, where our PhD program is located and the kind of work that we do in digital history. But an awful lot of sort of what we think of as the major programs are just really focused on these tenure track jobs. So this grant will now make it possible for the AHA and a team of helpers to work with four PhD granting history departments around the country to develop new career pathways for, you know, modify their curriculum, their advising, all the things that they do with students to help them develop new career pathways in what lots of people like to call the ALT-AC career track. And this is, you know, includes everything from becoming a museum professional, an archive or a library professional. One of my favorite examples of someone who's really prospered in the ALT-AC environment is Ann Wisenhunt at the University of North Carolina, who's an administrator at the university but continues to be a historian in all the ways that we think of being a historian. She does a lot of really great public history work, and she writes a lot about, you know, sort of the joys and frustrations of the alt-ec career. And so that's what this grant is really about. And for me, it's also, I wrote in the blog post, I think it's also a really important shift for the American Historical Association, which has really for its lifetime been focused on the things that I said the doctoral programs are focused on, which is the research historian and the needs of the research historian in the sort of classic sense. And so, you know, anybody who's ever written a big grant knows how much work it was and how much collaborative effort at the AHA it required to get a $1.6 million grant, and then how much work will be required to make that grant happen, you know, make all that work happen. And so this is a really major commitment by the association to be different than they have been in the past, and I'm really proud of that.
So I'm actually very excited that we've got the Digital History Fellows here with us, because I really wanted to get your take on this as well. Anne, would you care to tell us, you know, as somebody who is a graduate student in history right now, do you think that this is a good effort on the AHA's part?
Well, actually, yeah, I'm really excited about this. As someone who's been constantly told that if I don't do tenure track, I'm going for a Plan B job, which sounds really disappointing to me, because that's what I want to do. I want to do something that's not a tenure track job. I want to do something that's more like public digital. And that was particularly a reason why I was drawn to Mason, was because it seemed like there was that more of a freedom, if that makes sense. So I like that there is more of an AHA concept of that freedom as well, instead of just the standard, you know, you must have a book, you must do this, you must do tenure. Mm-hmm. And I, like I said, I've just always been disappointed to hear the Plan B jobs, and so I like that they're kind of being pushed forward now.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, and I think you're probably right that as someone who's a graduate student at George Mason University, where we have a really strong program in public history and digital history,
right,
in a way that assumes that they sort of overlap, right? You know, that digital history is public history, and
it absolutely is.
So, you know, your perspective may be a little bit different from people who are at something like NYU in the traditional history program, or somewhere like Columbia.
Right.
But Spencer, do you feel like Anne does, that this is a good thing?
Yeah, I think one of the more important aspects of the AHA sort of sponsoring this kind of change is that they're not just recognizing a change in the career options and the job market, but they're also reflecting a change in what PhD students want to do with their PhD. Like, mm-hmm. often it's a student decided, you know, especially here at Mason, I've observed that the students don't necessarily want to become tenure track professors, mm-hmm. But they still see value in getting a history PhD, and they are often the ones who are making those decisions. Whether or not the department would support that, whether or not there are courses designed that way, they're doing the history PhD for their own reasons, not necessarily the reasons that are handed down to them. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is an important recognition that that the department and the field, the discipline itself, is not necessarily the only force that drives these kinds of changes, that students themselves have often been the ones to lead that. So I don't know the exact numbers here at Mason, but often when I'm talking with my colleagues in the, you know, in the graduate program, they're often not thinking of becoming professors.
Right.
And I don't know the exact numbers, but it's probably less than 50% of them who want to be tenure track professors somewhere. For those of us who do want to do that, that's obviously a positive thing because it means less competition, but it's also eye-opening because...
Hunger Games!
Yeah, it's eye-opening because it also, the more people you have around you who are doing alternative work and who hope to have alternative careers, the more your eyes are open to those possibilities also.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that I think one of the initiatives that they're going to do with this grant money is exactly just informing graduate students about what their possibilities are, you know, once they get a history PhD besides a tenure track position. In the reporting on this grant, I don't think any of the news articles that I read specifically referred to a report that Rob Townsend did in conjunction with somebody else that came out last December. It wasn't the jobs report, but I think it was a sort of an earlier Mellon-funded initiative to basically track what people are doing with their history PhDs right now. So we'll link to that in the show notes. But they released a report back in December called The Many Careers of History PhDs, A Study of Job Outcomes. And they had taken a random sample of a few hundred people with history PhDs and tracked them down to find out what they were doing. And they had discovered, you know, that about 50% of them had tenure track jobs. And, you know, you can go farther down into the numbers and say, well, how long did it take them to get those tenure track jobs, right? Yeah. You know, is that 7 years out or is that, you know, immediately on graduation? That those kinds of numbers are disturbing. And then about, I think, 18% were on basically the adjunct track. And then, you know, about 5% they either couldn't find or, you know, in other ways were sort of excluded from the study. But the remainder of that, and so that'd be like 68, you know, a good 20-some percent.
24.2.
24.2. Thank you, Stephen. We're in other jobs. And that included a huge range of things, from everything from librarian and archivist to being in business, and so on. And you could easily argue, and it is probably true, that a lot of people were taking those positions, you know, that they could have gotten those positions without a history PhD, you know, that, I mean, obviously the history PhD had not necessarily been designed to put them into those positions. And yet, you know, the AHA has also been doing a series of what I do little videos in which people, you know, inevitably do say, look, maybe this wasn't plan A, but it's nevertheless true that what I did in my history PhD has helped me in the job that I have now.
Yeah, the other thing I would say that's worth keeping in mind is that, you know, the vast majority of post-secondary historians who have jobs at post-secondary institutions teach at institutions that don't even have a tenure track. You know, they are at community colleges, they're at smaller liberal arts colleges, they're at, you know, that don't do tenure, they're at a whole variety of teaching in kinds of institutions and contexts. And that's often seen in doctoral programs as, well, you know, that's kind of proof you couldn't get a real job.
Yeah.
And that's really, that attitude about what constitutes a real job is really in many ways what this grant is targeting, is to say, you know what, there are lots of real jobs. And the history PhD is excellent preparation for many of those real jobs, and they all have value, and they should all be valued by us, and so we're going to have some of our best doctoral programs prove that by building these tracks to help people secure those kinds of jobs,
right.
And so it really opens up the possibility for graduate students in history, whether at the MA level or the PhD level, because the fact is, you know, if you have courses for doctoral students in these areas, master students are going to take those courses as well. And so it's really going to ripple down through the graduate programs at these institutions. And I think it's just really a great thing.
I mean, I have to say that in my ideal world, we would have a university system that didn't rely as much on contingent teaching labor as it does now, right? Like, I actually think that in my ideal fantasy world, you would get a history PhD and then have only, you know, a minor amount of difficulty getting a good, reasonable, full-time job with benefits and all of that sort of thing. But that isn't the world that we live in. And I think that as a professional association, the AHA can only do so much. You know, they can't, you know, if you take this $1.6 million and say, okay, how many jobs could you create if you gave that $1.6 million directly to universities for the purpose of creating tenure track jobs, you could create something like 25 full-time jobs for like 1 year.
Not even close to that.
What's that?
Not even close to 25, more like 15, something like that. When you add in all the benefits that are required and the office space and the equipment and all that stuff, you know, maybe 15, and that's just for 1 year. If you wanted to say, we're going to create a couple of permanent history jobs, well, you know, you could endow You can endow one chair for about $1.6 million, or you could endow, I don't know, three assistant professorships or something like that, four assistant professorships. So this is going to really make a difference in the way that an endowment wouldn't. Also, you know, I think it's, you know, you were talking about the kinds of jobs that people get. You know, I worked for somebody when I was in graduate school. I worked for somebody who had one of those jobs. He was a historian at a federal agency and at the comptroller of the currency. Every federal agency has some historians on staff, one or more. But he had to have a PhD for that job. And then I was offered an alt-ec job right out of graduate school with a law firm here in Washington that wanted somebody with a PhD in history to help them with a whole series of lawsuits that they were filing over land claims in the American West. Now, my dissertation on Czech history wasn't going to help me so much with the land claims, but they didn't really care. You know, they wanted, they knew that I knew how to do research and I knew how to synthesize that research into a meaningful argument. You know, they would have given me the form that they wanted it in, and, you know, I'd have to learn some legal writing, which thank goodness I didn't. But just because it drives me nuts, but and they offered me a lot more money than, you know, if I'd taken that job, I'd be paid a lot better than I'm paid right now.
Yeah.
You know, 20 years out of graduate school. So I seriously considered it, largely because of the money, and ultimately chose not to, just because I couldn't imagine researching land claims forever. But but the pay and the benefits would have been great.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have gotten stuck doing the same thing forever. But so there are a lot of jobs out there, and the fact that we haven't structured our graduate programs in the way that we structure our undergraduate programs. You know, we don't train our undergraduate students to be history professors. We train them to do a whole wide spectrum of things. You know, some of them want to be teachers, some of them want to go work in a museum, some of them want to go on to law school. So, you know, they have a thousand things that they want to do, and we're fine with that. But at the PhD level, we don't seem to be fine with that. And so I think this is going to be a really positive change.
Yeah. I'd like to connect this, if I could, to another Mellon-funded project, which is the American Council of Learned Societies Public Fellows, which are postdoc positions in essentially embedded in public-facing institutions. And it seems like the associations that have academic street credit, like ACLS and the American Historical Association, are now getting involved in this, move towards letting students think about what careers they want to be prepared for and how a history PhD might help them. But also the fact that there are not as many tenure track jobs, but the public fellows program from ACLS is particularly intended to help postdocs who are specifically looking for a public facing position and a job in public service rather than in academia. And so I think there's definitely more people and more sort of academically recognized efforts.
Yeah, I love that program. I think that's a great idea. And I think that one of the things they're planning to do with this grant to the AHA, the AHA is partnering with four universities, including Columbia, and I forget what the other ones are, the University of New Mexico. And
Chicago,
one of the things they're... Chicago.
And UCLA.
And UCLA. They're gonna encourage those institutions to set up internships, which, you know, may be a bit of a dirty word, but, you know, literally just go into some other kind of job environment and see what's up. You know, I think that's always a good thing. And that's what I like about that ACLS Public Fellows program. It really is kind of the version of what I was talking about, where you take your million plus dollars and create a couple of, you know, a few temporary positions just to get people seeing from both ends what the value of somebody with this kind of a doctorate is.
I agree with everybody else in terms of my enthusiasm for this, and, you know, and Jim Grossman and the folk at AHA are really due kudos for getting this moving further on. Having said that, I'm at the end of the conversation, I guess, left to raise a couple of things that I find slightly curious about the details of this that are out there, and mainly this is in the Inside Higher Ed story. The thing that struck me, unsurprisingly in some ways, given what I read things for, is the almost entire absence of the digital from any of the plans that any of these four doctoral departments seem to have. And I would have thought there would have been an intersection with the kinds of things that go on and teaching digital history, which would have made it one of the things that these programs might have wanted to add to in exactly the way that Spencer and Anne were talking about. I mean, we obviously have a particular kind of take on that here at Mason. But, you know, all four of these programs, as far as they're talking about what they're going to do, are talking about connecting graduate students with professional schools and with internships and with broader career information. But they're not actually, they don't seem to think that the kinds of skills that are involved in teaching digital history, which is not, with perhaps the exception of UCLA, particularly prominent in any of those four doctoral programs, would be part of that conversation. And they're doing fantastic things here, and you can't do everything in a single grant. But I think it's interesting that, at least as it appears in the public declarations, that there hasn't been a connection made between this and the digital. And then I guess the one other thing that also is interesting is all of these doctoral courses are programs are talking about doing something to their coursework, and so there's nothing in here about opening up what a history dissertation would look like in a way that might allow students to do things in a dissertation that would take it out. That's still a big chunk of what any history PhD is going to be about, probably more of a history PhD in purely kind of quantitative terms than the coursework would be. And I think obvious next step to this kind of conversation might be going from the much richer sort of options that are going to be presented to students in coursework through these kind of models to thinking about what the implications of that would be for the dissertation as the thing that continues to anchor and perhaps arguably limit in some ways what a PhD represents.
That's a really good point, Stephen. When I had my one-year grant-funded position a few years ago to do curricular reform for the Archives and Public History Master's Program at NYU, one of the things that was, in a way, super easy because we had a lot of support for it from the director of the program, was to widen the definition of what your final project could be. I mean, it had traditionally been a thesis, and we said, hey, you can do a website. You know, you can do a number of different kinds of things. So it's true that I don't see indication of that in any of the announcements, but that is a tremendously good idea. You know, let people do something else besides just a specialized monograph.
And it's certainly the case now that you can kill a few birds with one stone here, that getting the kinds of scholarly training that the dissertation represents can be done without it having to be bound in a large stack of paper and filed in your library, so that it's not an either or kind of situation. But it's one of the things that, again, you can't do everything at once, and you would think that the kind of conversations that this project will provoke and promote will actually lead in that kind of direction, I think, somewhat inevitably.
Yeah. All right. Any other comments? Tremendously interesting initiative for sure. And as somebody whose doctorate is in English language and literature, I'm hoping to see similar things maybe from the MLA soon. So we'll see about that. So moving on to another story. This broke quite recently within the last week. There is a lawsuit between Duke University Press and a scholarly association called the Social Science History Association. And this story is about a dispute over ownership and essentially copyright, I think, of the journal. They had an agreement that the scholarly association would publish their journal with the Duke University Press. The scholarly association wanted to terminate that agreement, in part apparently to see whether they could make more money on their journal, although that isn't quite clear. If they published it with a sort of a private publisher like Wiley or Blackwell, it's conceivable that they could make more money. But in any case, for whatever reason, the scholarly association is attempting to sever its relationship with the university press that publishes its main journal, and there's a great deal of dispute over who owns the whole concept of the journal. Joan, you work in new models of scholarly publishing in your work with Press Forward. What do you think of this lawsuit?
I think it's interesting that it's gotten to the point of a lawsuit rather than court just discussions between the two groups. The National Council on Public History in the past couple of years has been having a similar question about their arrangement with University of California, Santa Barbara as a co-publisher, but with the association of its own journal. And but they have remained on the level of conversations between the editorial group, the council leadership, and it's a little bit more of a question about trademark and the ability to move editorial responsibility. So I think this is definitely seems a little bit more like a business decision rather than, or a question of a business operation rather than a question of sort of the goals of the journal or maybe the shifting goals of the editorial board. But what I think is interesting here is the way it kind of reveals all the different ways that journals and associations can get paid or some form of payment or recouping their costs, if you will, for a journal publication. And in fact, the money doesn't always come from the publisher directly, for example, like from Wiley or from Duke, but it often comes from the aggregators. So it could be more layered than just having Duke University Press be the publisher. It could be the decisions that Duke is making in terms of where the content is being aggregated, whether it's Project Muse or ProQuest or JSTOR, things like that. So it kind of opens a Pandora's box, I think.
Yeah, I wish I know more about that distinction between the publisher and the aggregator of the electronic content than probably most people, and I still don't understand it. You know, I think there are, you know, academic libraries who have electronic resources librarians who do nothing but kind of manage the various contracts with these different entities. And so I think you're absolutely right, Joan, that like where journals make their money is not a simple proposition. I think I understand that it's almost never from individual subscribers. I think individual scholars very rarely subscribe to individual journals, unless of course that subscription is part of their scholarly association membership, which it often is.
In fact, those aren't very often very expensive either.
Right.
For a humanities journal, they might be, you know, an individual subscription might be $100, and there aren't going to be enough individual subscribers to necessarily support the extent to which a lot of these journals are published and distributed.
Right.
Yeah, if you look at the income statements for the and the budgets for the American Historical Review, you know, the vast majority of the money is made through advertising in the journal, and almost, you know, I don't know, 75-80% of that comes from textbook publishers, likely, probably, or just, you know, from trade publishers, and so it's, you know, there is still a substantial amount of the AHR budget that comes through subscriptions, but it's usually library subscriptions and advertising that make up the more substantial chunk of the revenue for the journal. The thing that really fascinated me about this story is, you know, the Social Science History Association is relatively small as scholarly associations go. It's only about 1,000 members, according to the Chronicle story. And so therefore, the membership run of the journal is pretty small. And as these things go, I mean, the American Historical Review run is very large compared to that. And this is a journal that probably does not have a very high impact factor. And so The fact that Duke is willing to lawyer up and fight over this says that there's money in Numnar Hills. And because, you know, if they were losing money on this journal, they would say, yeah, sure, no problem, take it, we don't want it. And so the only reason that I can think of that they would fight over this is about money, and that they were making money through the kinds of things that you guys were talking about, or, you know, other sorts of relationships related to this journal. because it's not like it's the most prestigious journal out there. I read the journal on a somewhat regular basis, and there's some really great content in there, but it's not the American Historical Review with its number one impact factor. So it's not over the prestige. It's either they don't want to set a precedent and lose all their journals, or they're making money on this and they don't want to give up that income stream for whatever reason.
Spencer, you were making some interesting comments about this before we officially started the podcast. You were saying something about how from the reporting and the news stories, it seems as though the journal itself as an entity is weirdly separate from either the people of the scholarly association who publish it or the people at the university press.
Yeah, I was just commenting on the very small snippets that they provide from the legal contract, sort of sets it up as not a sort of an association seeking a competitive publisher for their journal, but that these two groups, the publishing company and the association, said, let's create this journal, and the language says that if one of them decides not to participate, they just notify the other party, but it doesn't say that the journal will cease to exist. Mm-hmm. So the journal continues with one participant rather than two, which suggests also that it could continue with no participants if both sides said they didn't want to be part of it, which is obviously not going to happen. It needs a publisher and it needs content from an association, but the way that they've constructed this contract seems to be setting a journal apart from its association and also apart from its physical form.
And apart from the intellectual property, which is the interesting version of that language, that somehow if social science history doesn't want to publish with Duke gets left with this thing called the journal, which at some level they don't own. Because I find the other extra wrinkle in this also particularly strange, in that there's a parallel contest going on between the association and Duke about the trademark for Social Science Association and Social Science History, which the association has tried to claim, I would assume, as part of, you know, what Duke gets and what doesn't, and that Duke is challenging. And I find that kind of inexplicable, that the trademark Social Science History Association could somehow not belong to the Social Science History Association, and that organisations need to be suddenly in the business of trademarking themselves if they're in this kind of relationship.
But, and trademarking early rather than in a looking backwards, because that's actually one of the issues in the National Council on Public History and UC Santa Barbara case.
So NCPH has not trademarked NCPH?
No, it was decided that they jointly shared the trademark.
Really? Because I was thinking, I saw that to where, so the journal is called Social Science History, and the association is called the Social Science History Association, and they are now, because of this lawsuit, attempting to trademark both of those terms. And I was assuming that, you know, trademark office or whatever it is at the government that decides these things would of course say, oh, well, you have been using this term for so long, clearly that's yours. But I guess in the case of the journal, which is more or less owned by the university press, that's the part I don't get, is the, I mean, I guess that's what the lawsuit is trying to decide, is like,
right.
Duke are essentially claiming that they do own the journal, right, and therefore that they have some ownership of those trademarks, I presume, even though they're somehow not kind of claiming the intellectual property in it. I assume that their claim would be based on the same logic, that somehow the journal belongs to them,
right,
and the association.
But given that, my understanding is that they were not the original publisher, from the very beginning, so it would be an interesting argument to make that 20 years after the journal started to exist, you became the publisher and therefore assumed the trademark.
Well, Spencer's point I did find kind of interesting, because, I mean, it's true that the journal could stop publishing, right? But that doesn't mean that the journal ceases to exist. I mean, we just had an Orphan Works roundtable a couple of weeks ago where the Copyright Office was debating over these orphan works. And because, like, these issues of the journals will always exist in some point and have been digitized and are available through, right, I assume they've been digitized, and or at least some of them, and are available through databases and stuff. I mean, there's that's got to exist in perpetuity, right? I mean, somebody 20 years from now could need to consult one of those articles, even if the journal were to stop publishing tomorrow. So this question of who owns that intellectual property has to be resolved.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention that going forward, if Duke decides that they want to continue publishing the journal, but the association decides that it doesn't want to be a part of that, now you have two competing journals,
that's right,
one of which used to be associated with the association and now isn't, and presumably they now have their own separate one. It makes you wonder, why would you, instead of bidding and trying to be competitive as a publisher, why would you essentially set up a situation where you're going to create your own competition for that journal?
Social science, history, electric boogaloo.
Well, but even that would be an interesting exercise. Even if Duke claimed the journal, are they really going to attempt to staff a competing social science history journal? I mean, that's the logic for the case kind of escapes me. I cannot imagine that they're really interested in trying to reformulate it.
Right. It would be easier for the association to take its content and become its own publisher than for the publisher to find its own content or
right.
find new content.
Absolutely.
Having spurned the social science historians.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's baffling, I've got to say. I'm a bit lost over this story as I say, even as someone who considers herself reasonably informed about the bizarre nature of scholarly communication, this kind of thing is still sort of baffling. So, one final story before we conclude the news portion of the podcast. In the sort of mainstream tech news, apart from all of this very inside baseball stuff about academia and scholarly communication, they have been talking a lot about wearable computing, including smartwatches and Google Glass. Mills, I think you have some ideas about what wearable computing means for academia.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting story that we're going to link to in the show notes from the New York Times, because it's as the story points out, it's really about a war of ecosystems between Apple and Google, and just yet another device or devices that will help lock you into their particular ecosystem, whether it's Google Glass or an Apple smartwatch or whatever it might be. But, you know, so I think that alone is kind of an interesting story. And it's something that we've talked about a lot on the podcast over the years, is these kind of competing and rival ecosystems. And what does that mean for academia? You know, do you really commit to being an Apple person or to the Apple part of the world, or you know, so that alone is interesting, and it's just another front in that war. But I think what actually is more interesting about this is just where we're headed with wearable computing and the Internet of Things, and the Internet of Things, which all of a sudden every big corporation in America is trying to figure out why we're not in the Internet of Things already.
Yes, that's hugely in the news, you know, coffee makers with, DRM and all kinds of things.
But I remember the first time I ever heard of wearable computing, and it was at a meeting that Kevin Key at Brock University pulled together, and the book that came out of that meeting was just published by the University of Michigan Press, a brief plug for that book. It's called Pass Play, and Bethany Novitsky from UVA was at that meeting, and she was talking about wearable computing, and when she said that, I looked at her and just kind of did that look that you get where you think, huh?
Mm-hmm.
what are you talking about? and so she showed, you know, she had like sewing projects with her that where she was sewing digital devices into things, and I thought, now, okay, it's kind of cool. Well, I was at the Think Lab at Mary Washington back in the winter, and one of the students who was there was telling us about some of the wearable computing projects that they're involved in. She and her friends were involved in, and her project for the semester was that she created a messenger bag. And it had a surveillance camera in it.
Oh.
And So she could, like, you know, go to the cafeteria with her friends and put the messenger bag down on the table and kind of surveil everybody. And so that was her project. But a friend of hers created a skirt that, depending on the motion of the skirt, different lights lit up in different sequences. But this was a computing thing. There was a microchip which ran that.
Right.
So what does this mean for the humanities? You know, where I think this has the greatest inflection point is going to be in museums and other kinds of public history spaces, where we think about the ways that people interact with data, and the way that we can make that happen. And you know, Bill Turkell has been pounding away on this for years and years, and so you know, he started this museum of Laboratory for Humanistic Fabrication, and we all also said, huh? But that was, you know, Bill started that, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, and so when it just seemed kind of freaky, and now it's moving mainstream, and so I think, you know, we should link to some of Bill's work in the show notes, because I think especially in public history contexts, wearable computing is going to have some really interesting applications.
Yeah, one of the first VAT camp workshops, I think it was Great Lakes VAT camp, Bethany Novisky came and showed people how to use essentially electronic embroidery thread to make. So they had a t-shirt at Great Lakes VAT camp that had a light bulb on it, right? Because they're sort of the land of Edison. And people got to hack their VAT camp t-shirt so that the light bulb lit up. Which was pretty great. And it's sort of, I mean, a lot of that kind of thing is, you know, sort of it's aligned with the general digital humanities ethos of making, right? And fabricating and hacking and building it yourself, you know, the hack not yak type of thing that, or what Steve Ramsey has called, you know, the hermeneutics of screwing around, or, you know, the hermeneutics of building, really, you know, that you obtain knowledge through making something that you just don't in other ways. So yeah, this is all very akin to the trends in 3D printing and all of that. And as you began by talking about Mills, it's all also akin to the general issue of whether people can hack these devices, right? Can you, you know, if you get a Google smartwatch, are you gonna have to go through their whole, you know, system and policies before you can make that smartwatch do anything? Or are you going to be able to take it apart and, you know, plug other things into it to make it jump up and roll over?
That you mentioned smartwatches, and I think in some ways the New York Times story that started us on this is a lot less interesting than all of the things that you've just been talking about. Because it ultimately is about wearable computing in a much more literal, far less creative sense, beginning with smartwatches. And there's a throwaway line in that story about, you know, analogous wearable computing, which mentions shoes, accessories, and then the one that really gets me is tattoos.
Smart
and the tattoo is wearable computing. I think I would love to know if there is actually somebody out there doing wearable computing tattoos. But I think that, but just to go back to the smartwatch is what they brought into that. I mean, I think it is, as I said, a much less imaginative, much less kind of interesting form of wearable computing. That kind of sort of bizarre fascination with the wrist as the only place where you could wear computing. And then the ultimate problem, of course, with all of those smartwatches, whether they're the ones that are out there already or the kind of Android Wear one that they're promoting here, is that they're supremely ugly. I mean, they've got to be the least likely to be worn wearable computing that I can imagine. They're all one version of another of kind of the ugly square watch, the kind of digital watch that I can't but help associate with the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is the, you know, the destined to fail kind of style. And if there's going to be something interesting in wearable computing, it's not that conversation. There's, I think, another ecosystem stretching but not clear where your watch would fit into your ecosystem of devices. Does it replace your phone? Doesn't it? You know, this story seems to be about, you know, getting beyond the smartwatches out there at the moment, which are simply extensions of your phone, into something else that may or may not replace your phone. But But I think there's a big gap between, you know, what that story's talking about and what Mills is talking about, which is very much from the maker culture, you know, wearable
right.
computing as a way of hacking, as opposed to what Google and Apple seem to be fighting about, which is wearable computing as the next device that you need. And I think the obstacle there really is that I'm not sure why we need those devices, and they're going to have to be a hell of a lot better designed than any of these smartwatches before we're going to really be thinking about that.
Well, I was never sure why I needed my cell phone until I had it and bonded with it. But
and I think that there's a third ecosystem out there, and that's the maker ecosystem, and you know, web communities like Thingiverse and others that where people are, you know, really proceeding from the ethic that if you can't open it, you don't own it, and you know, if you can't take it apart and hack it, then it's not yours. And certainly I can't take my iPhone apart and hack it. If I were a better hacker, I could probably hack the software, but I still can't. If I open it up, it's pretty much doomed. And so whether it's using Raspberry Pis, you know, Mark Sample on Twitter drives most of his Twitter bots with a Raspberry Pi, sitting at his in-laws' house in somewhere in the States, mm-hmm. While he's abroad. So that, you know, people are doing that sort of thing. My younger son spends a lot of time with his various little computing devices that he's tacking together into various ways, and so that's really going to be the third ecosystem. That's where people in humanities, digital humanities, are going to make the biggest impact.
Yeah. I mean, I really have to say, I do see this a lot from a kind of a pedagogical viewpoint. You know, in the sense of that, I really do believe pretty strongly in that. You know, you need to make it, you need to build it in order to figure it out. And in order to sort of unleash your creativity and so on. Whereas something like this Google smartwatch, I can imagine some, you know, smart developer creating some kind of flashcard app for that smartwatch that will educate you with the smartwatch by, you know, showing you flashcards. And they're like, well, that's all very well, but I think it would be much more interesting for me to, you know, train somebody to be that developer who can make that app and have that be the education, you know, rather than, you know, assuming that education is something that other people build for you and force you through. All right, well, some interesting thoughts about that. And I think that concludes our news portion of the podcast. And then just to wind up, we wanted to have a report from the center from Joan about what she's been doing recently with the Press Forward project. Joan, can you tell us a little bit about just what Press Forward does and what you've been doing most recently?
Sure. And right now we are gearing up for a widespread public release of our Press Forward plugin. And that is a plugin for WordPress that facilitates the aggregation of content via RSS feeds and the curation of those posts for distribution through your own website. So what we're doing at the moment is the final testing and preparation of user documentation and user guides as well. So in a couple weeks, you'll be seeing a lot more about that. But I can just describe what the plugin does for just a minute. And that is as I mentioned, it facilitates the aggregation of content via RSS. And the way it does that is it essentially recreates Google Reader in your WordPress dashboard. So it provides an interface for collecting all those posts, a really nice interface for reading them. We send everything through Readability, so it essentially is just a stripped down version with text and images. It's very much like Instapaper. There's also a space for reviewing and an ability for anyone who has an account on your WordPress installation to offer comments on any of those posts and nominate content for distribution on the front end. So this is in fact how we run our weekly curated publication, Digital Humanities Now. We aggregate content from over 600 RSS feeds. And we have about 6 volunteers a week who sift through those posts and nominate content for wider dissemination through the front page of Digital Humanities Now and over Twitter. So we are in the process, like I mentioned, of finalizing the documentation, writing up some pretty detailed user guides for how you might create an aggregated and curated publication like Digital Humanities Now, questions to ask yourself before you embark on such a journey, and check marks to use as you are developing it. And then we're also going to have some user stories, so what this process might look like if you are an editor or just a contributor. And then we're going to be offering support for its use in a user forum. We're going to be presenting at workshops and offering presentations for starting at George Mason and then around the country, too.
Great. Glad to hear it.
So you can find links for those in on the site.
Yeah, I think I've got a link for that, pressforward.org/the-pressforward-plugin.
That's correct.
Separated with some hyphens. So that's great. I'm not sure when the podcast will be published, but if it goes up before next Wednesday, voting might still be open for new members of the That Camp Council. We've already had, over 80 people voting for the four open slots of the first That Camp Council, which is going to take over management and direction of the That Camp project/movement, whatever you like to call it, after I leave the center on March 31st. So I will still be on the council for a year. And Tom Scheinfeld is also going to be on the council. And he's not with us today, as he usually is on the podcast, but I'm sure he'll return. And then Patrick Murray-John is going to be the representative from the center on that council, and then we're currently electing four other people. So if you've ever been to a That Camp, if you have a thatcamp.org account, you can log in to vote for your chosen members of the That Camp Council. Well, I think that's about all we have for you today. Thanks to everyone for being with us. Thanks especially to Anne and Spencer for putting together a great list of stories. And we'll see you on another episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv. where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.